where valuations are too high, where leverage needs to be refinanced, and where investors after 2022 were happy to extend and pretend for 2 or 3 years. And now, again, with what's happened in the last 3 months in the Middle East, that has gone away. I maintain that real estate is a way of investing in infrastructure, and it really helps us price risk. We are creating new social infrastructure. So we're buying land and building a hospital or something like that. And we're doing it at very low leverage, and it's very useful in terms of social impact. And the risks you take there need to be paid for. So investors, I think, more and more looking at the underlying principles of what your fund is doing, and can you deliver that risk management process?
In February 2024, we released an episode titled Investing in Essential UK Social Infrastructure. It was with the founder and CEO of Newcore Capital, Hugo Llewellyn. Hugo and I had met years earlier when we were both on the investment committee of the Great Ormond Street Hospital. He was the property expert. I'm not sure actually what I was doing there, but anyway, we got to know each other, and we're back today on this curated edition to both reacquaint investors with the investment thesis and discuss why the investment opportunity might be so compelling, to talk about where capital is scarce, where opportunities exist, the priorities in execution, the return profile that's being targeted, and why this area might just be AI-proof. So, Hugo, welcome back to the Money Myths podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I think it would be really helpful just to start with a recap on the business. Briefly, ownership, people, mission.
Absolutely. We're still wholly management owned. We've been growing steadily since really 2022, when there was the sort of change in the cost of capital. And I think people were looking at risk in a different way. We've benefited from that, having positioned ourselves prior to it. We're now about 750 million under management. We're on our way to about a billion. We're not trying to be an asset gatherer. We're trying to invest well for our investors. And we are tracking on all our kit to date since inception in 2011, about 4 or 5% ahead of inflation over that time scale. So delivering real returns. And that's what you want from, you know, real assets linked to infrastructure, of course. We've just had the first close of our sixth fund on the value add side. And the income fund, which we raised last year, is going along well as well. So we're in a sensible position.
Well, we'll break down, you know, a number of those, you know, components later on. But I did go back and listen to our episode, and you were very clear and in articulating the strategy and the execution. And at that time, we had used the Monopoly Board analogy to talk about the properties that you would really want to own, which weren't Park Lane and Mayfair, but were utilities and railway stations, which plays to your theme. Now, in the meantime, of course, because I have to confess I am fascinated with military history, I discovered that MI9, which was the military intelligence unit in the Second World War, sent to prisoner of war's Monopoly Boards. And in those Monopoly Boards were disguised everything from compasses, metal files, coded messages, escape routes, and maps folded so thinly they looked like ordinary paper inserts. And under the free parking area, there were even hollowed out, there was a hollowed out area for tools that could be used to plan the escape route. This summer, I am going to retrace the Pyrenean escape route that the prisoner of wars who made it, you know, took it. So I won't have my Monopoly set with me, but I was struck by that. Let's just pause on your name of the business, Newcore. Has the definition of core evolved in the last few years?
Yes, I think it always is. And we originally called the business Newcore Capital back in 2011 because we wanted to invest in assets that were core to society, but new to the institutional mainstream. And the funding of which was becoming more relevant to the private sector because perhaps after the GFC, public sectors weren't funding so much in terms of health or education and these sort of areas that we're focused on. And that continues to be the case today. So the three or four main pillars of our business are real estate assets that we lease, enabling healthcare, education, and transport related services, not roads, but things like motorway services, car parking, you know, heavy goods storage and that sort of thing. And so those remain core, but on the edge of the mainstream. So very relevant for us. And then you've got incoming trends and the increasing prevalence of things like food security, energy security, security itself, obviously, in terms of defense. And those open up real estate opportunities where we can own land and buildings that enable those services or the provision of them.
And the landscape's shifted a little, evolved, as you just said. Has anything changed in your investment process?
No. The key thing in our investment process is the clear exposition that inflation is there and it's going to be there for the long term. And I think a lot of investors up to 2022 borrowed the QE sort of gilt yield playbook. And if you're investing in real assets, you might have before 2022 said, well, gilts are at naught or one, and therefore real estate returns, if we get four plus that, you know, five or something, we're fine. That was a fallacy, obviously, and it's caught a lot of investors out. We always took the view that inflation was bubbling along at 2-4%. There were two things going on in the world, which are more emphasized today, but were the case before 2022. One is the climate transition, and that is expensive and inflationary. So getting the world onto a sustainable footing for the long-term future and away from fossil fuels is expensive. And the cost of doing that brings inflation. So that carries on. The second thing is about deglobalization. And as countries sort of near shore all their systems, and they also realize that they've got to think more carefully about their own food security, water security, and energy security, then that's inflationary as well. And you might have said in the recent months that you couldn't have predicted the Straits of Hormuz and the inflationary shock that that's providing. But if you looked on a wider basis, you could see very clearly for some time now that deglobalization was going to cause the breakdown in this fragile sort of, you know, sort of supply chain across the world. So we, back to the investing point, we have always believed that you need to get paid a proper real return for investing. And there are times where we haven't been able to invest in scale because the opportunity hasn't been there. Now the converse is true, and we've been raising significant capital and putting it to work into these dislocated markets when a lot of private markets funds are on the sidelines.
Well, we might come back to that particular issue of where the market is. Just help me understand how you find these investable opportunities.
Yeah, it's 15 years of relationships and deal doing and doing what we say we're going to do. And if I take the different sort of thematics, perhaps, so healthcare, there is a specialist market out there of agents and developers who are working with the NHS, with doctors, with vets to help them find the capital for their service, for their operations. And those agents, and indeed the underlying sort of principals themselves, the counterparties, know that we are in the market for that sector. We probably own about 40 or 50 doctor surgeries now. We've bought a lot in the last two or three years. And also we're looking at working with the NHS. So then that's a sort of long journey into the public sector of working with the right people in the NHS itself. And so it comes with experience. And even if you've got the relationships, it doesn't necessarily mean the deals that they're prepared to do are right. So you've got to keep that investment discipline of making sure you get paid the right amount of return for the risk you're taking by owning bricks and mortar, enabling it.
Well, we all heard about the problems of those who are building new stuff in terms of regulations. In dealing with government and its arms, as a counterpart and in terms of getting stuff done, how frustrating or actually how executable is it?
Yeah, we've never found it frustrating because I think you naturally, as an entrepreneurial business, you see where the opportunities are and you invest time where activity can actually happen. But I do spend a lot of time with the public sector, and I'm really like the people in the public sector. They're trying hard and they've got a very difficult set of issues. Now, who caused the set of issues is, you know, doesn't matter. But the people who are working there now, and if you're in a local government, for example, you know, really very decent people with completely sort of stuffed balance sheets in terms of the amount of borrowing that's taken place in the past, the legal obligations on them to provide social care, education, waste services and so on, which is absolutely fair enough, and caps on things like council tax, it's incredibly difficult to run a local authority. But what is changing now, and I think particularly so that interest rates are going back up again, so the pressure's back on in terms of their own operating budgets, where they've got a lot of interest payments to make, is that they need private sector solutions. So there needs to be a more... There need to be more options for the public sector working with the private sector and not just sort of PFI or something, which, as you know from our past discussions, I'm not a particular fan of. And I think you now have a more of a willingness amongst the public sector operators, or if they may be the commissioners of private sector businesses in some of the things that we underpin with our property. So that is the cost squeeze, inflation squeeze means that there is increasing interest on working with a private sector fund manager with us, particularly, I think, if you can show that you're responsible and, you know, you're trying to do things in the right way.
So let's talk about these two elements, where the opportunities are most compelling and then where the capital is most scarce. You've talked about healthcare, education, transport. How do you prioritize? How do you balance the portfolio?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we tend to be about... a quarter in education, a quarter in healthcare, quarter in transport-related real estate, and then a quarter in other. And other is an interesting area. So civic, so things like law courts. And I was in Oxford Crown Court the other day as a juror. I'm not a guilty party, I have to say. But sitting there, you can see that Oxford Crown Court needs a massive upgrade in terms of its M&E, you know, it's sort of the air conditioning and the quality of the building and everything else as well. And that hasn't happened for a long time. So it's likely that the Ministry of Justice hasn't got the budget to upgrade these facilities, to future-proof them. And that is an area where we can come in and we can own the property and they can lease it and off you go. And you create sort of government income in that case. And then, so that should cost government a pretty low price for equity risk transfer and the responsibility of, you know, managing the building and everything else. But it's not on its balance sheet as well. So civic is an interesting area. And there's a lot of change to how things like police stations are happening where they're presented, and we can be part of the change as a change agent in that. We are interested in areas like waste recycling, where that can happen. And for us, it's not really the waste recycling plants themselves, because so much of the value is in the kit, in the incinerators or the anaerobic digesters. But for us, it's the ancillary parts of waste. So we own quite a few storage assets where, you know, Biffa park their bin lorries, and that's great. Because if it's not Biffa parking the bin lorries there, someone else will be doing it, and they're always going to be bin lorries, and they always need to be parked somewhere. So we like owning that sort of thing. Commuter car parking, as you know, people return to the office more and more, and we're trying to think of these new core themes, as you say, which are essential to society and won't get disintermediated by the internet is one thing. AI, of course, is a whole new ball game as well.
Is your business, you know, actually ironically as AI proof as one can find?
It's an impossible question to answer, because I wrote an article in 2014 called Follow the White Rabbit, which is based on the Matrix film. And, you know, in the time of the Matrix, the things that you want to invest in then were data centers and human farms. So human farms, where we all get plugged in and our energy is used to, you know, fuel the computers. So are we going to a world like that? If so, it doesn't really matter, does it, whether we're AI proof or not. Let's have a slightly more optimistic view of the future. And we are doing everything we can to be a real world investor and to own assets that will be needed. And it does take a lot of thought because things are changing so fast. And if you look at office investment, for example, the generally considered view amongst the sort of city analysts and so on is that offices are going to get a pretty big crunch coming on them because AI will really reduce the demand for office space. Now, again, that may or may not be true depending on how AI develops, but we don't have that with things like doctor surgeries, with childcare, and you're trying to do these primary human or primal even human things where people really want face-to-face contact and where the need is actually there.
Let's talk about capital and capital scarcity.
Yep. Scarcity, that's a good word. And again, you know, and it reflects in your some of your other podcasts. I think you agree with my view that the world of private markets, whether it's UK or in Western economies generally, has got quite a lot of hidden issues. They may be less hidden than some managers would like to say, but you've got a lot of legacy private equity, private infrastructure, and private real estate, and whether that's equity or credit is probably still the same issue, where valuations are too high, where leverage needs to be refinanced, and where investors after 2022 were happy to extend and pretend for 2 or 3 years. And it was just getting to the point, I think, where people thought, well, interest rates are going down and we might be able to refinance or sell at a better price. And now, again, with what's happened in the last 3 months in the Middle East, that has gone away. So I think we're going to see quite a lot of forced liquidity coming out of private markets funds. And that is an opportunity if you've got capital, but it's very hard to raise capital because all the principal investors who were perhaps thinking they'd get that money back to reinvest have got some other issues. So turning to Nucor, we have been fortunate in two ways. One is we've sort of gone up the ladder to be big enough and relevant enough to the investors who are in our funds as they pool and grow in size themselves. And secondly, we've had this fairly contrarian view of the world and a view of risk as well, i.e. inflation is there everywhere and you can hide it with QE, but it's still there. So, and that, because we've fixed all our liabilities in terms of interest rate sort of swaps on our any borrowing, we've delivered good returns and therefore we have raised money. And we've raised about 220 million in the last 12 months or so, including the first close of this fund that we've just done, which is our next value add fund.
So the issue that came up on an investment committee on which I sit the other day was infrastructure versus real estate. And there's this, the investment world likes to put things in boxes because then it makes it easier, even if that's not the right thing. You know, you're running a social infrastructure fund that is essentially built, it's real estate. That's what you do. How should and how do allocators look at the space? Is it changing? And how do they reflect on what you do?
Yeah. So for a long time, I would be sort of banging my head against a brick wall to say to investors, you can have equity, real estate, or you can lend money. Those are options. Infrastructure is a theme, and however you choose to access it, those are your three ways or three funds doing that. Two things are changing. One is, I think people are realizing more and more that, in a care home, sort of looking after old people, or in a water company, answering the phone to the customers who may or may not be happy, is a very different skill from generating secure, inflation-growing cash flow for your investors. So I think the last 3 or 4 years have really given so many examples of that investors have got the message. And secondly, there's this growing move towards a sort of total portfolio approach as investors. And I think that's the sort of the culmination of this, which is investors are saying, well, there are, real estate qualities in some things that we want to look at that as a real estate growing cash flow, or an infrastructure as part of that, or that's credit or that's equity. So I maintain that real estate is a way of investing in infrastructure, and it really helps us price risk. And if we, let's see, our value add funds are targeting sort of 12 to 14% returns. And We are creating new social infrastructure. So we're buying land and building a hospital or something like that. And we're doing it at very low leverage, and it's very useful in terms of social impact. And the risks you take there need to be paid for. And they are completely different to the risks of, say, a value-add equity infrastructure fund, sort of trying to turn around a water company or something and make it 12 to 14 as well. So, and probably with quite a lot of leverage in it. So investors, I think, more and more looking at the underlying principles of what your fund is doing and can you deliver that risk management process. So that's really good for us. And the other thing I think is still continuing, which is the continuing prevalence of impact investors, notwithstanding everything that's going on in the sort of the DESGing of the world. I don't think that is a thing. I think you know, all the investors coming into our latest fund really care that we are doing things in a sustainable way. So we've got past the issue of are we property or infrastructure now, I think, and which is exciting because it feels to me that the logic is sort of winning out.
So you mentioned leverage in the industry and how deleveraging and asset sales are likely to be sort of, you know, part of the part of the landscape. Just talk a little bit about how you apply leverage.
Yeah. Well, we want to deliver returns that are coming from the underlying asset class. So bricks and mortar enabling essential services. And if you and therefore we price our required returns on that whole sort of dynamic. If we then apply leverage afterwards, that is a choice in terms of bringing in volatility and control elsewhere in what we're doing. But if you bring in too much leverage, you're moving from being a risk manager to being a sort of gambling manager. And that is what happened pre-2022. So this concept of value-add funds in the real estate space tends to be own assets that you sort of buy, fix, and do up and sell, and then apply 60 to 70% gearing in terms of loan to value against it to try and juice the returns to sort of, you know, mid to high teens. And the problem with that is you were taking a lot of risk in, you know, everyone knows the planning process, and if you've refurbished your house and stuff, it always takes much longer and costs much more. So the risks are there. You need to get paid for them. Putting leverage in as well did, in the good years, pre-22, if you call them that, make very strong returns for people. But you didn't know when the Liz Truss mini budget was coming along, and all those investors then ran into the brick wall. And what you see now, and some very big names involved, were trying to unwind 60 or 70% LTV positions against pre-22 valuations, and also their asset values have fallen as well. So they've got a double problem, and interest rates have gone up. So we took the view that let's be a real estate investor, and we'll use up to say 30% gearing on an LTV basis, which is pretty modest and moderate compared to the private markets funds. To be fair to the listed sector, actually, most of the listed sector has tried to keep below 40% gearing. Their boards of the good boards of the big property companies have stopped that going over the top. So, but that is a more sustainable long-term leverage level, I would say, than trying to borrow 70%. Now, if you're an investor who wants the tactical things, says, right, we'll do this, we'll borrow that much money, we'll get a 30% increase on the value, and that's a 2x on equity on a 70% loan, then great. Everyone's grown up, they can go for that. And then, but if values fall by 15%, they lose half their money. So I'm not trying to lecture other people about how to do leverage. It's just, I think for what we're doing, if we have investors who have very sensible return expectations and we keep our leverage low, we can then use more of the cash flow for CapEx and improvement. We're not focused on using all our cash flow to pay increasing interest rates or, you know, shareholder loans coming back or whatever. And that has worked well. And I think one of the big issues across both social and economic infrastructure is that the over leverage has dragged cash flow away from essential future proofing and CapEx and into repaying banks and other lenders.
And how do you reflect on sticky inflation and higher long-term rates and investor expectations?
Yes, I think the first thing to say is that governments have an absolute sort of prerogative to try and run high inflation and low interest rates if they can get away with it. And they have been getting away with it for the last few years. It's just extraordinary that, you know, bond rates until the last few months in the UK were at sort of 4% for long-term bonds, for, you know, 10-15 year bonds, and inflation was running at 3%. So there was sort of, you know, your real returns were really getting eaten away. And but that, I think that's now coming to an end. Trump's actions in Iran and so on have really caused a sort of interest rate sort of movements upwards across the Western world. And I think every time it happens, investors realize that they need to get paid for it on a long-term basis. So sticky inflation is with us. And therefore, where do you invest to get to preserve your purchasing power? And it's not an easy question. I don't think there are that many places that you can reliably do so. And we don't have all the answers. But the way that I look at it is, what can we own that's a real asset? And by real asset, I think I mean something that's genuinely needed, because there's no point owning a property asset that no one wants to occupy because it's become obsolete or the function has changed and the, you know, people aren't using that anymore. So own that. Make sure it's affordable. That's really critical. Make sure it's dignified. And in the UK, it's a sort of strange word, dignified, but, you know, you want to own assets that people want to be in. So, you know, we have not got involved in sort of real estate assets enabling immigration facilities and things like that. You know, we talked about the jail in Monopoly last time around, and, you know, the extraordinary social infrastructure facilities in a sense, but there's not a lot of dignity in some of our prisons, unfortunately, which is another question. So if we can own those things, if we can link our income to inflation as it goes along, but with the rent still remaining affordable, then we can get a return that's overall reflects the property risk and the illiquidity of property. And it takes sort of 3 to 6 months to sell something, so you want to get paid for that compared to gilts or equities. Then that is that has a place, I think, in portfolios. It's exactly the opposite of owning Bitcoin or an asset that might do a 20x. You know, we're there trying to do a sort of steady 10% IRR across the board in what we're doing.
So you've got, if I understand it correctly, when you wear the investor lens, you've got in the UK this public sector, private sector dynamic, where the public sector is cash strapped. You've got a rethinking around the whole ESG issue. You've got illiquidity that is hurting sort of private market players with the attendant, you know, behavior. As you think about attracting capital, how would you define risk appetite of the allocators?
Yeah, I think the risk appetite of the allocators is different, obviously, for different cases. One of our main constituents in terms of our investor base is the local government pension scheme. And they are well funded and in many cases in surplus, and therefore, and also they're growing pension schemes as well, and their defined benefit. So they can take on long-term real asset risk as part of their portfolios. That has been very positive for us. And, you know, I think 8 underlying investors in our current fundraise have been through local government pension schemes, plus some European investors and some family offices. And and that's great. Where on the other side of that coin, you've seen a lot of insurers doing buyouts of corporate DB schemes, and indeed in some cases around the local government as well. And that has been negative for real assets because those investors want credit risk, that it reduces the cost of their own sort of funding, and therefore they are off real estate and probably off equity infrastructure as well as an asset class. So it swirls around, and I think in the end it comes to pricing. So if you want to be able to market and successfully raise a real estate fund, whatever your theme is, you've got to demonstrate, I think, that you're solving a solution in society, i.e. providing capital into an essential need, that there is going to be long-term demand for what you're doing, and that you can provide a return that is attractive compared to, you know, that 30-year bonds now 5.7%, I think, as of today. So it's, you've got to be 3 or 4% over that to make it worth the while of the investors. And the final thing is, I think, which just get back to my first point, is that can you demonstrate positive social impact, and can you demonstrate that you can future-proof buildings by decarbonize them as well? So those are all the sort of the asset level issues. And if you can do that, I think you can raise money, but it's not easy.
Which brings us all the way around to having studied your business and visited your offices and looked at it now sort of at two different sort of, you know, periods in time, I am struck by what appears to be a very good and evidential culture that you have built. And I know you're a B Corp, and I know that may or may not mean something to some people, but talk to me a little bit about what it is culturally that you are trying to develop and to have as the common sort of, you know, way in which people identify your business.
Yeah, I think sort of courtesy with humor is my response to that. And I don't think in fund management you need to be a sort of aggressive alpha male in the traditional investment banking sense. I think risk management is the opposite of, you know, red bloodedness. You've got to be very dispassionate about what you're doing. And I think we can make tough decisions in a clear and rational way, and in a courteous way as well. You know, as someone said, after a yes, the next best answer is a quick no. And because at least you go back to the people and say, we're not going to do this. So we try and keep that culture, try and keep the entrepreneurialness of it, and try and keep the sort of humanity in it. It sounds a bit trite, doesn't it? But hence the humor and making people think about what we're doing. Capital management is the most critical piece of the financial plumbing of society. You know, running capital in a sustainable way, in a courteous way for the long term is what it's about. And because we're management owned, we can keep trying to do that without influence from other shareholders who might have a different agenda as well. And I think what I find as well is you're not going to be on everyone's list in terms of investing in our funds or that sort of thing, but there are a huge constituency of investors out there still who care about doing things in the right way. And we have got a open door into that market to at least to go and meet them and tell them what we do, even if they don't invest with us. So I think, yeah, humor with courtesy, or courtesy with humor, whichever way around you, whichever is more important to you.
Well, Hugo, thank you for coming in today to refresh the, you know, investment thesis around what you're doing. I can see that you are, you know, as full of conviction as you were last time. I think the opportunity set has actually got better and the competition may have got weaker. But three things, you know, struck me. Number one, your expression, real estate is a way of investing in infrastructure. And if I go back to, I think it was the Australian Super Fund, where Mark Delaney, the CIO, referred to infrastructure being the ballast in the boat. It does strike me that, you know, it's a important potential element to any, you know, serious investment allocator, number one. Number two, your areas, healthcare, education, transport, and civic, whether that's law court or other, are areas that needs to be funded on, as far as we can all work out, are going to continue, you know, to be necessary. I'll just take away your last comment about building businesses and those two essential ingredients, courtesy and humour. So it's been great catching up with you today, and best of luck as you move forward.
Thank you, Simon. Very good to be back on with you.